Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do a couple of chapters on Jewish control of the music industry from Henry Ford's The International Jew, written back in 1920-21 over a couple of years, about 90-91 issues of the Dearborn Independent newspaper out of Michigan. See what it was like in, we've seen earlier the stage and movies, and last time we saw Jews in baseball. This time we're going to talk about music and Jewish control within that industry, the way they use popular music to debase, sexualize, and immoralize the public mind. Chapter, let's see, what are we up to? 47 and 48 is what we're going to do. Chapter 47 is titled Jewish Jazz Becomes Our National Music. About a year ago, the following, and you can find everything we do at vnnforum.com. Jewish Jazz Becomes Our National Music. About a year ago, the following article appeared in the New York Times, a newspaper that has never been accused of anti-Semitism, and whose proprietor is one of the best-known Jews in the United States. And follows a block quote from the New York Times. Quote, Irving Berlin, Leo Feist, and other officers of seven music publishing corporations in this city were charged with violating the Sherman antitrust law in an equity suit begun yesterday in federal district court by the United States government. The defendants, it was alleged, controlled 80% of the available copyrighted songs used by manufacturers of phonographs, player piano rolls, and other musical reproducing instruments, and fixed prices at which the records or rolls were to be sold to the public. The corporations involved in the action were the Consolidated Music Corporation of 144 West 37th Street, Irving Berlin, Inc., 1567 Broadway, Leo Feist, Inc., 231 West 40th Street, T.B. Harms, Francis, Day & Hunter, Inc., 62 West 45th Street, Shapiro Bernstein & Company, 218 West 47th Street, Watson Berlin & Snyder, Inc., 1571 Broadway, and M. Whitmark & Sons, Inc., 144 West 37th Street. The agreement which the government seeks to dissolve is alleged to provide that the defendant would make contracts only through the Consolidated Music Corporation, which they had organized. So they organized a cartel for the music industry and owned most of the 80% of the copyrights of the music that was going out to everybody. Many people have wondered, says Ford, whence come the waves upon waves of musical slush that invade decent parlors and set the young people of this generation, again, 1920-21, imitating the drivel of morons. A clue to the answer is in the above clipping. Popular music is a Jewish monopoly. Jazz is a Jewish creation. The mush, the slush, the sly suggestion, the abandoned sensuousness of sliding notes, meow, are of Jewish origin. That kind of thing. Monkey talk, jungle squeals, grunts and squeaks and gasps of suggestive of cave love. Cave love. Are camouflaged by a few feverish notes and admitted to homes where the thing itself, unaided by the piano, would be stamped out in horror. Girls and boys a little while ago were inquiring who paid Mrs. Rip Van Winkle's rent while Mr. Rip Van Winkle was away. In decent parlors, the fluttering music sheets disclosed expressions taken directly from the cesspools of modern capitals to be made the daily slang, the thoughtlessly hummed remarks of high school boys and girls. The United States government alleged in the above complaint that 80% of these popular songs was under the control of the seven Jewish houses named above, and the other 20% controlled by other Jewish music houses not included in that special group of seven. It is rather surprising, is it not, that whichever way you turn to trace the harmful streams of influence that flow through society, you come upon a group of Jews. Gee, isn't that almost exactly what Hitler said, except even before he wrote it in Mein Kampf? That everywhere you shine the light upon some social abscess, a Jewish maggot wanders out? Henry Ford is saying in 1920 or 1921, it is rather surprising, is it not, that whichever way you turn to trace the harmful streams of influence that flow through society, you come upon a group of Jews. In baseball corruption, a group of Jews. In exploitative finance, a group of Jews. In theatrical degeneracy, a group of Jews. In liquor propaganda, a group of Jews. In control of national war policies, a group of Jews. Absolutely dominating the wireless communications of the world, radio, a group of Jews. In the menace of the movies, a group of Jews. In control of the press through business and financial pressure, the advertisers, as well as the publishers, a group of Jews. War profiteers, 80% of them, Jews. Organizers of active opposition of Christian laws and customs, Jews. And now, in this miasma of so-called popular music, which combines weak-mindedness with every suggestion of lewdness, again Jews. The Jewish influence on American music is, without doubt, regarded as serious by those who know anything about it. Not only is there a growing protest against the Judaization of our few great orchestras, but there is a strong reaction from the racial collusion which fills the concert stage and popular platform with Jewish artists to the exclusion of all others. The American people have been urged and chided and shamed into the beginning of a rather generous popular support of music in this country, and the first thing they see for their money is that Jewish artists supplant the non-Jewish artists, as we saw on stage, and use the prestige of their membership in symphony orchestras to work various small business schemes of their own. If they were superior artists, nothing against it could be said, but they are not superior artists. They are only better known and racially favored in Jewish music circles. That, however, is a big subject. It will receive attention in its turn. Just now it is the, quote, popular song, unquote, that is being considered. However, as something that true lovers and knowers of music may meditate upon in view of the future studies of Jewish influence in music, this observation is offered. The italics are ours. Quote, block quote. Meanwhile, the Oriental, especially the Jewish infection in our music, seemingly less widespread than the German was or the French, is, may prove even more virulent. Those not temperamentally immune to it catch it less severely, like Mr. Leo Ornstein, and if they ever throw it off, as he has given some signs of doing, seem to be left devoid of energy and, as it were, permanently anemic. Quote, the insidiousness of the Jewish menace to our artistic integrity is due partly to the speciousness, the superficial charm and persuasiveness of Hebrew art, its brilliance, its violently juxtaposed extremes of passion, its poignant eroticism and pessimism, and partly to the fact that the strain in us that might make a head against it, the deepest, most fundamental strain, perhaps, in our mixed nature, is diluted and confused by 100 other tendencies. Quote, the Anglo-Saxon group of qualities, the Anglo-Saxon point of view, even though they are so thoroughly disguised in a people descended from every race that we easily forget them, and it is not safe to predicate them of any individual American, are nevertheless the vital nucleus of the American temper. And the Jewish domination of our music, even more than the Teutonic and the Gallic, threatens to submerge and stultify them at every point. And that's the end of the block quote. Let me make a nation's songs, and I care not who makes the laws, said one. In this country, the Jews have had a very large hand in making both. It is the purpose of this and the succeeding article to put Americans in full possession of the truth concerning the moron music that they habitually hum and sing and shout day by day, and if possible to help them see the invisible Jewish baton which is waved above them for financial and propaganda purposes. Make money and make politics out of popular music, popular culture. Just as the American stage and the American motion picture industry have fallen under the influence and control of the Jews and their art-destroying commercialism, so the business of handling, quote, popular songs, unquote, has become a Yiddish industry. Its leaders are for the most part Russian-born Jews, some of whom have personal pasts which are just as unsavory as the Dearborn Independent has shown the pasts of certain Jewish theatrical and movie leaders to be. The country does not sing what it likes, but what the vaudeville, quote, song pluggers, unquote, popularize by repeated renditions on the stage until the flabby mind of the 10-20-30 audiences begin to repeat it on the streets. These song pluggers are the paid agents of the Yiddish song agencies. Money, and not merit, dominates the spread of the moron music, which is styled, quote, Jewish jazz, unquote. Of the business details, however, more later. Tin Pan Alley, so-called because it constitutes a group of, quote, song shops, unquote, is populated by the Abies and Izzies and Moes, who make up the composing staffs of the various institutions. In this business of making the people's songs, the Jews have shown, as usual, no originality, but very much adaptability, which is a charitable term used to cover plagiarism, which in turn politely covers the crime of mental pocket-picking. The Jews do not create. They take what others have done, give it a clever twist, and exploit it. They have bought up all the old hymn books, opera scores, and collections of folk songs, and if you stop to analyze some of the biggest hits of the Yiddish song manufacturers, you will find they are woven on the motif and the melody of clean songs of the last generation, the music jazzed a little, the sentiment sensualized very much, and set upon their smutty road across the country. Because of absolute Jewish control of the song market, both in publishing and in theatrical performance, it is next to impossible for anything but a Jewish song to be published in the United States or, if published, to get a hearing. The proof of this is in the fact that the Yiddish Trust owns the business and the so-called, quote, song hits, unquote, all bear Jewish names. A typical incident occurred in New York recently. A non-Jewish song composer had produced work of such commanding merit that musical sentiment demanded its public rendition. Jewish manager after Jewish manager was approached, but the combination was unbreakable. Remember the seven companies that are controlling this entire market, and even he says even the ones that aren't part of the 80%, the ones that are part of the 20% of outsiders are still owned by Jews. Jewish manager after Jewish manager was approached, but the combination was unbreakable. Finally, one New Yorker talked out and said something about, quote, Jewish combine, unquote, which had its effect. A Jewish manager protested that he would be glad to give the work to the public. Rehearsals were held, and the night of the presentation arrived. The first number was a solo, and a Jew appeared to sing it. He could not pronounce English words. He sang through his nose. He was most Yiddish in appearance, the long nose with narrow, sloping forehead and curly hair. The second number was a duet, and behold, two Jews appeared, whose pronunciations differed between themselves. The performance was a most hilarious tragedy. The purpose was to kill a non-Jewish product by a poor Jewish rendition, but Jewish manager overdid it. It needed just that to bring non-Jewish musical consciousness to the surface and to explode the advertised and money-bought notion that the Jew has predominant artistic genius. Say that he predominates in music. Yes, he has paid for and organized that predominance. Do not, however, say anything about his predominance in musical genius or art. Non-Jewish music has been stigmatized as, quote, highbrow, unquote. It is purveyable only an expensively good society. The people, the masses, are fed from day to day on the moron's suggestiveness that flows in a hurtful flood out of Tin Pan Alley. Tin Pan Alley is the name given to the region in 28th Street between Broadway and 6th Avenue, where the first Yiddish song manufacturers began business. So see, some Jews over there in New York are running sweatshops and mass-producing clothing. Other ones are mass-producing garbage songs. It's all just another industry to the Yid. flocks of young girls who thought they could sing and others who thought they could write poems or song poems came to the neighborhood, that is, lyrics, came to the neighborhood allured by dishonest advertisements that promised more than the budding Yiddish exploiters were able to fulfill. Needless to say, scandal became rampant, as it always does where so-called, quote, Gentile, unquote, girls are reduced to the necessity of seeking favors from the Eastern type of Jew. It was the constant shouting of voices, the hilarity of parties, the banging of pianos, and the blatting of trombones that gave the district the name of Tin Pan Alley. The first attempt to popularize and commercialize the so-called popular type of music was made by Julius Whitmark, who had been a ballad singer on the minstrel stage. He ceased performing to become a publisher and was soon followed by East Side Jews, many of whom have become wealthy through their success in pandering to a public taste, which they first debased. Irving Berlin, whose real name is Ignatz or Isidore Baline, Baline, is one of the most successful of these Jewish song controllers. He was born in Russia and early became a singer and entertainer. With the rise of, quote, ragtime, RAG-TIME, which was the predecessor of jazz, in quotes, ragtime, the predecessor of jazz, he found a new field for his nimble talents, and his first big success was Alexander's Ragtime Band, a popular piece which, by comparison with what has followed it, is a blushing, modest thing. It was worth noting, in view of the organized eagerness of the Jew to make an alliance with the Negro, that it was Jewish jazz that rode in upon the wave of Negro ragtime popularity and eventually displaced the ragtime. So, jazz rode in on ragtime and became more popular, eclipsed it in popularity. Berlin has steadily gone the road from mere interestingness to unashamed erotic suggestion. He is the, quote, headliner, unquote, in homes, as well as in the not-too-particular music halls. And his stuff, but his stuff, without its music, sometimes savors of vile suggestion. Of course, always sexual, per the Frankfurt dogmas of the Jews policy. Destroy Jew criticism and Jew awareness among the Gentiles by getting them obsessed with sexual things. Loosen society through this vile suggestiveness that pours from every official institution and every aspect of culture. The motif of this business can be clearly seen in the, quote, Berlin Big Hits, unquote. There are the so-called vamp songs, such as Harem Life and You Cannot Make Your Shimmy Shake on Tea. Among the successes, quote unquote, is the song entitled, quote, I Like It, unquote. It is a vamp song, V-A-M-P, which has been sung everywhere, even by myriads of children who could not appreciate the full suggestion of the words, but were hypnotized by the atmosphere which the words created when sung, and by older folks who would not under any circumstances speak the words of the song, but who are victims of the modern delusion that a little flashy music covers a multitude of sins. I Like It deals with a girl, Mary Green, 17, in quotes, whose mother reproves of her for flirting with the boys. In the writing of this paragraph, it was debated whether the Dearborn Independent should print what Mary replies to her mother. It was argued that printing the words might give a salutary shock to skeptical readers. Again, this shows you how absolutely comparatively wholesome and pure and naive Goyim really were back in 1920 compared to what we have today, because you can imagine that what we have today is 100 times more sexualized than the stuff that they were complaining about back then. It's really astonishing how far we've come degree by degree under the Jew and his complete domination of all the mass media. So they had an internal argument at the Dearborn Independent over whether or not to print these lyrics to this song, I Like It, and they decided not to. It was argued that printing the words might give a salutary shock to skeptical readers. It was also argued that the pages of this page never yet had been defiled by obscenity. Mary's words, sung broadcast through the country, are therefore not given here. So if you like, look it up. I Like It. Mary Green, 17. Readers should reserve comment until they search the piles of moron music rubbish in their own parlors. Readers have listened to much worse stuff than Mary's Words, but covered by Yiddish, quote, jazz, unquote. It takes cold type to show what a song really is. A good test for a song is to try to read it aloud. Few normal people can, because they're embarrassed by it. Ohio, as song O-high-o, as in quotes, as sung by Yiddish comedians, has a stench of its own. It may be commented on more extensively later as an example of the Yiddish practice of having three grades of the same song to suit different degrees of degenerate appetites. They'll say one for stage and one for the general consumption, like public airwaves, and one for the stage, that's even dirtier, and then one for the lowest sorts of houses. That's the dirtiest of all. We'll hear later. Such songs are not the worst by any means. Jewish purveyors to degenerate appetites have a peculiarly devilish system of presenting the same song in two or three grades. There will be the song as it is sold at the music store to addlepated young men and women who fill their leisure with hearing or humming this syncopated senility. Young men and women who pitiably imagine they are keeping up with the times. The songs thus sold are sung and rotten enough, but there is the same song, class two. The theme and the melody are the same, but it goes, quote, a little further, unquote. There is a line or two in each stanza which dips below even the low standard which Jewish jazz has permitted in some of our parlors. And there is class three. Same theme, same melody, but, quote, going the limit, unquote. Young men about town usually know class two and class three. The instance has been known that young women have become acquainted with these lower grades also. Forgetfulness by young men while singing at the piano evenings has given hints of the filthier version. So just like, I guess life really was like you'd see in some of those films where they would, that was their entertainment. They'd gather around the piano and one person would sing and the rest of them, or play, and he or the rest of them would all sing. You see, so he's saying that the men would know some of the racier stuff, and it just, without thinking, they would use that even in these cleaner parlors so that the women were becoming exposed to it too. Very, very, very different society from what we have today. And, you know, a more recent example, in very recent days, Miley Cyrus acting as a sexualized baby in a crib. At the same time, we have articles earlier this year, 2015, when I come to you, and it doesn't matter because the material we do here, the whole purpose of the Learning College is evergreen material. That evergreen means it never goes away. It's always true. It's permanently important. So all of this stuff from Jews is coordinated, and it crosses media as well. So they take a goy star like Miley Cyrus, who was a kid star, Hannah Montana, and they have her portraying a baby, now that she's an adult, but a sexualized baby. At the same time, in other of their media, like Salon, they're promoting pedophilia. Now that they've achieved queer marriage, they move on to transsexualism and pedophilia. So they're always promoting degeneracy, but they do it subtly, degree by degree, drip by drip. So I talk about 100 years after he was writing. Back then it was simply getting some jazz into people's homes and then degree by degree making it racier and racier and having, even at the same time, three different levels of dirtiness. Jews are experts in pandering to vices, both to make money, although that's a secondary concern, to gaining complete political, racial, mental control of a goyish society, formerly wholesome, or at least having some agreement on basic standards. Young women, or young men about town, usually know class two and class three, the dirtier versions. The instance has been known that young women have become acquainted with these lower grades also. Forgetfulness by young men while singing at the piano evenings has given hints of the filthier version. And even where version one has been strictly adhered to, the mutual knowledge, politely concealed, has created an atmosphere far from wholesome. The diabolical cunning, that means devilish, cunning with which an unclean atmosphere is created and sustained through all classes of society and by the same influence will not be overlooked by any observer. There is something satanic about it, something calculated with demonic shrewdness. And the stream flows on and on, growing worse and worse, to the degradation of the non-Jewish public and the increase of Jewish fortunes. And again, this is 1920. If the Dearborn Independent were to print on this page the bare words of the popular songs that are to be found in the parlors of the most respectable section of every city, the reader's sense of decency would cry out against it. The same words, when drawn out by numerous hyphens and covered up with nervous music, insinuate their way into the hummed tones of the age and into the lilts of innocent childhood. Between the movies and the popular songs, the Jewish groups dictate the intellectual life of the masses. So by controlling music and stage and popular songs and the radio, Jews control what the masses are thinking. I ain't call it intellectual life, but it's not even really intellectual. They control their emotions and what they're thinking, how they perceive things. Among the latest Jewish song hits may be included these titles. I'll Say She Does. Quote, "You cannot shake that shimmy here, Sugar Baby, in Room 202. Can you tame wild women?" Women spelled W-I-M-M-E-N. An almost endless list of the same nature. Some of the titles are too suggestive, some of which titles are too suggestive for print. Yet they have free course everywhere, as everything Jewish does in this country. Ministers, educators, reformers, parents, citizens who are amazed at the growth of looseness among the people rail at the evil results. They see the evil product and they attack the product just like a bull attacking the cape. They rail at the young people who go all in for this eroticism and suggestiveness. But all this has a source. Why not attack the source? When a population is bathed in sights, sounds, and ideas of a certain character, drenched in them, and drowned in them by a systematic, deliberate, organized intent, the point of attack should be the cause, not the effect. Yet that is precisely where the point of attack has not been made. Presumably because of a lack of knowledge. Actually, it's due to fear. They know that it's coming from a Jewish source, but they're afraid to attack it because the Jew has a ready retaliation, as he said in an earlier chapter. So they content themselves with complaining about the water on the floor and ignoring the Jew who turned on the tap. This is the figure I prefer to use. All this has a source. Why not attack the source? There's no reason not to. All logic says that we should. It is of little use blaming the people. The people are of what they are made. Give the liquor business full sway, and you have a population that drinks and carouses. After preaching abstinence to the victims for a century, the country turned its attention to the victimizers, and the abuse was greatly curtailed. The traffic is still illicitly carried on, but even so, the best way to abolish the illicit traffic is to identify the groups that carry it on. That's actually wrong. They created massive profits for Jewish criminals through prohibition. And yeah, I don't agree with him here. I mean, strengthening criminals and cops is the wrong way to go about vice patrolling. The entire population of the United States could be turned into narcotic addicts if the same freedom was given the illicit narcotic ring as is now given the Yiddish popular song manufacturers. But in such a condition, it would be stupid to attack the addicts. Common sense would urge the exposure of the panderers. A dreadful narcotizing of moral modesty and the application of powerful aphrodisiacs have been involved in the present craze for popular songs, a stimulated craze. The victims are everywhere. But ministers, educators, reformers, parents, and public-spirited citizens are beginning to see the futility of scolding the young people thus diseased. Common sense dictates a cleaning out of the source of the disease. The source is in the Yiddish group of song manufacturers who control the whole output and who are responsible for the whole matter from poetry to prophets. Next to the moral indictment against the so-called popular song is the indictment that it is not popular. Everybody hears it. Perhaps the majority sing it. It makes its way from coast to coast. It is flung into the people's minds at every movie and from every stage. It is advertised in flaring posters. Phonographic records shriek it forth by day and night. Dance orchestras seem enamored with it. Player pianos roll it out by the yard. And by sheer dint of repetition and suggestion, the song catches on, as a burr thistle catches on, until it is displaced by another. There is no spontaneous popularity. It is a mere mechanical drumming on the minds of the public. There is often not a single atom of sentiment or spiritual appeal in the whole loudly trumpeted, quote, success, unquote. Men and women, boys and girls, have simply taken to humming words and tunes which they cannot escape, night or day. The deadly anxiety of keeping up with the times drives the army of piano owners to the music store to see what is going, quote-unquote, now. And of course it is the Yiddish moron music that is going, and so another home and eventually another neighborhood is inoculated. But there is no popularity. Take any moron music addict you know and ask him what was the popular song 3 weeks ago, and he will not be able to tell. The songs are so lacking in all that the term popular means as regards their acceptableness that they die overnight, unregretted. Directly, the Yiddish manufacturers have another, quote, hit, unquote, to make. It is always the public that is hit. A new song is crammed down the public gullet, and because it is the latest, and because the Yiddish advertisements say that it is a hit, and because the hired pluggers say that everybody is singing it, that song too becomes popular for a brief period. Pluggers and popular and hit, all in quotes. For its brief period, and so on throughout the year. It is the old game of changing the styles, quote unquote, to speed up business and make the people buy. Turning everything into the equivalent of fashion with various seasons. Quick, 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 turnover, turnover, turnover. Make more money. Nothing lasts in the Yiddish game. Styles of clothing, movies, nor songs. It is always something new to stimulate the flow of money from the popular pocket into the moron music maker's coffers. There hasn't been a real popular song of Yiddish origin since the Jewish whistlers and back alley songsters of New York's East Side undertook to handle musical America. Not one. Unless we accept in genuine gratitude George Cohan's, non-Jew, Irish, Over There. A song which came out of a period of strain and went straight to the people's heart. That related to World War I. Two facts about the popular song, quote-unquote, are known to all. First, for the most part, it is indecent and the most active agent of moral miasma in the country, or if not the most active, then neck and neck with the movies. Second, that the popular song industry is an exclusively Jewish industry. But the inside story of the operation of this control of the people's music presents other facts which the people ought to know, and these additional facts will appear in another article. So that ended this one of two chapters we're doing on Jew control of popular music. This one appeared 6 August 1921 and was made into chapter 47. Now, chapter 48, How the Jewish Song Trust Makes You Sing. Jews did not create the popular song, semicolon, they debased it. Jews did not create the popular song, they debased it. The time of the entry of Jews into control of the popular song is the exact time when the morality of popular songs began to decline. So the moral debasement of debauchment of popular music and popular culture was always found to be coincident with the assumption of Jewish control. The minute Jews come in, quality goes down and debauchery goes up. Jews debase culture. It is not a pleasant statement to make, but it is a fact. It would seem to be a fact of which American Jews ought to take solemn cognizance, not to anathematize those who do service by exposing the fact, but to curb that group of Jews who, in this instance, as do other groups of Jews in other instances, bring a stain upon the Jewish name. The quote-unquote popular song, before it became a Jewish industry, was really popular. The people sang it and had no reason to conceal it. The popular song of today is often so questionable a composition that performers with a vestige of delicacy must appraise their audience before they sing. There are songs and choruses that can be purchased in any reputable music store and found in many reputable parlors, which cannot be printed in this column of the Dearborn Independent. If they were printed here, Gentile fronts, in quotes, would be the first to complain that this paper was using obscenity to give interest to these articles. Yet if these songs were printed, this paper would be doing nothing more than following its policy of going to Jewish sources for its material. Americans of adult age will remember the stages through which the popular song has passed during the past 3 or 4 decades. War songs persisted after the Civil War and were gradually intermingled with songs of a later time, picturesque, romantic, clean. These latter were not the product of song factories, but the creation of individuals whose gifts were given natural expression. These individuals did not work for publishers, but for the satisfaction of their work. There were no great fortunes made out of songs, but there were many satisfactions in having pleased the public taste. The public taste, like every other taste, craves what is given it most to feed upon. Public taste is public habit. The public is blind to the source of that upon which it lives, and it adjusts itself to the supply. Public taste is raised or lowered as the quality of its pabulum improves or degenerates. In a quarter of a century, given all the avenues of publicity like theater, movie, popular, song, saloon, and newspaper, in the meantime having thrown the mantle of contempt over all counteractive moral agencies, you can turn out nearly the kind of public you want. It takes just about a quarter of a century to do a good job. In other days, the people sang as they do now, but not in such doped fashion nor with such bewildering continuity. They sang songs nonsensical, sentimental, and heroic, but the shady, quote-unquote, songs were outlawed. If sung at all, the shady songs were kept far from the society of decent people. Like the styles of the demimonde that formerly, that's the low-end prostitutes, criminals, bars section of society, like the styles of the demimonde that formerly were only seen in the abandoned sections of cities, the songs of smut had their geographical confinement to the red light district. But like the fashions of the demimonde, they broke out of their confines to spread among polite society. The old songs come readily back to memory. Though years have intervened since they were the fashion, yet their quality was such that they do not die. The popular song of last month, who knows its name? But there are songs of long ago whose titles are familiar even to those who have not sung them. Recall their names. Listening to the Mockingbird. What song today has been boosted to general acceptance on such a simple theme? The only birds the people are encouraged to sing about today are flappers and chickens, both in quotes. And there were Ben Bolt, Nellie Gray, Juanita, the old folks at home. Hey, that's funny because there you still find in the Midwest old women who are named Juanita. It's not a Mexican thing. They're not Mexican. They're white. And that must have been it. There must have been a vogue for that name back in the early decades of the century, whenever that was popular. I've never heard the song, but other songs. The old folks at home. The Hazel Dell, When You and I Were Young, Maggie, Silver Threads Among the Gold. What margin did these songs leave for the suggestive, for the unwholesomely emotional? In those days, the people sang. They sang together. They sang wherever they met. It was the days of that now extinct institution known as the singing school. People could sing together. The songs were common property, known to everybody, proper to everybody. Is there such singing today? Hardly. At a recent meeting of the young men in a church, the chorus, Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here, was called for, and the chairman in agreeing called out, Mustn't say the naughty word. With that warning, the chorus was given. In calling for the public singing, there is an immediate uneasiness about possible indecency. There was not this uneasiness before the days of Jewish jazz. In course of time, the fashion of public song underwent a change. An entirely new crop of titles appeared, dealing with an entirely different set of subjects than the songs they displaced. It was the period of, quote, Annie Rooney, all these are going to be in quotes, Down went McGinty to the bottom of the sea. She's only a bird in a gilded cage. After the ball is over, all of them clean. Lighter than the preceding fashion in songs, but just as clean, and also giving a true touch to life. Sentiment was not lacking, but it was the unobjectionable sentiment of My Wild Irish Rose or In the Baggage Coach Ahead. The non-Jewish period was marked by songs like these, : On the Banks of the Wabash by Paul Dresser, In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree, When the Sunset Turns the Ocean's Blue to Gold, Down by the Old Mill Stream, My Sweetheart's the Man in the Moon by Jim Thornton, The Sidewalks of New York by Charles Lawlor. There was also the Western and Indian strains of songs, represented by Cheyenne, Hop on My Pony, Arowana, Trail of the Lonesome Pine. Then came the African period, being the entrance of the jungle motif, the so-called Congo stuff, into popular pieces. High Up in the Coconut Tree, Under the Bamboo Tree, and other compositions which swiftly degenerated into rather more bestial type than the beasts themselves arrive at. Running alongside all this was the ragtime style of music, which was a legitimate development of Negro minstrelsy. Lyrics practically disappeared before the numerous cakewalk songs that deluged the public ear. There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. The marching song of the Spanish-American War belongs to that period. The black and tan resorts of the South began to reign over the nation's music, both North and South. Seductive syncopation captured the public ear. The term Ma Baby, brought in on the flood of Negro melody, has remained in uncultivated musical speech ever since. Minstrelsy took on new life. Piano acts made their appearance. Jazz bands were the rage. By insensible gradations, now easily traceable through the litter of songs with which recent decades are strewn, we have been able to see the gradual decline in the popular song supply. Sentiment has been turned into sensuous suggestion. Romance has been turned into eroticism. The popular lilt slid into ragtime, and ragtime has been superseded by jazz. Song topics became lower and lower until they were at last were dredges of the slimy bottom of the underworld. The first self-styled king of jazz was a Jew named Frisco. The general directors of the whole downward trend have been Jews. It needed just their touch of cleverness to camouflage the moral filth and raise it half a degree above the natural stage where it begets nothing but disgust. They cannot gild the lily, but they can veil the skunk cabbage, and that is exactly what has been done. The modern popular song is a whited sepulcher, sparkling without, but within full of the dead bones of all the old disgusting indecencies. Plain print returns them to their rightful status of disgust. So, using a biblical figure there, the whited sepulcher, that's something that's a tomb. We are now in the period of the vamp, that great modern goddess upon whom tens of thousands of silly girls are modeling themselves, the vamp. The original vamp is to be found in a forbidden French novel upon which Maurice Gest, G-E-S-T, founded his grossly immoral spectacle called Aphrodite, which is a play they've complained about in earlier chapters. In the Jewish popular song and the Jewish motion picture film, a unity has at last been reached in the vamp. The vamp heroine and the harem scene, a fitting climax. There is work here for the Anti-Defamation League. That league knows how to put the screws on anyone who disparages the Jews. From important New York publishers down to inconsequential country newspapers, the ADL makes its power felt. There is work for it in the movies and the popular song industry. Why does not the league put the screws on those Jews who have degenerated the movies and debauched the popular song movement and thus brought shame upon the racial name? Why not? Is it possible that only the non-Jews are to be controlled and the Jews to run loose? Is it possible that Gentiles can be curbed by as by bridle and bit that Jews cannot? It is repeated. There is work for the Anti-Defamation League among the Jews. But of course, the ADL was founded to blame Goyim for convicting Leo Frank a Jewish pedophile, serial debaucher of Aryan girls, and a murderer. They were founded because they were outraged that he had been found guilty and sentenced to death. So you're not going to look for any moral correction from the ADL when it comes to roping their own kind in. What they're going to do is defend and make excuses for them, even if they're a goddamn pedophilic murderer. And again, we don't know if Henry Ford fully understood what was to be overtly publicly expressed. Well, of course he did, because it was in the protocols in a more simpler, more condensed form. That what they said in Frankfurt was, we're going to destroy the Goyish societies by loosening them up so that they will lose their anti-Semitism in the midst of their sexual throes and focus and obsessions. More than that, going back to Ford, there are Jews who beg the ADL to purge the name of Jewry of the shame the liquor Jews, the movie Jews, the popular song Jews, the theatrical Jews, and others are bringing on that name, and the ADL has not done so. It dare not. American Jewry is desperately afraid of opening a single seam in its armor by means of a single investigation or reform. They are afraid of how far the fire of self-correction may spread. It was the intention of the Dearborn Independent to give in this article a sample of the manner in which Jewish jazz is written in three classes. Number one for general consumption, number two for stage consumption, and number three for the lowest resorts. On searching through the songs for the least offensive example, it is found that even the least offensive cannot be printed here. The fact is greatly regretted, for certainly some method must be found by which the public can be put into possession of full information as to what is transpiring in this hideous traffic. The Jewish art of camouflage, in quotes, the reader may not be aware that wartime camouflage was a Jewish invention, has always been operative. Cover names or cover nationalities, these are Jewish terms, have long been known. It is quite common for Jews of the higher type to band themselves together into societies for political and racial purposes, the purposes being camouflaged by a name, such as Geological Society or Scientific Society or something of the sort, and thus in the vilest versification, which only a few years ago would have been refused to males, they have flung broadcast among the youth of the world dangerous ideas under the camouflage of catchy tunes. The tunes themselves carry a tale with them. There have been cases in the courts dealing with the, quote, adaptation, unquote, or stealing of tunes for, quote, popular song, unquote, purposes. If you observe carefully, you will catch reminiscent strains in many of the popular songs which you sing. If you sing Rocked in the Cradle of the Deep, and then sing I'm Always Chasing Rainbows, you will notice a basic resemblance. But that does not prove that Rocked in the Cradle of the Deep is itself original. Its melody was originally taken from an opus of Chopin. This is a practice which has been greatly extended of recent years. The reason for the spreading of this particular kind of dishonesty is to be found in the Jewish policy of speeding up business, in quotes. Ordinarily, one play a week, or one or two new songs a season, was the limit of indulgence. But with the coming of the movies, the one play a week plan has been smashed to smithereens. To get the people to pay their money every day, the programs are changed every day, and to get new plays every day, something must be cheapened. So with songs. The output is rushed to increase the income of money, and the quality is sacrificed all round. There are not enough good songs in the world to supply a new one every week. Not enough good plays in the world to supply a new movie every day. And so what the songs and plays lack in worth, they make up in nastiness. In brief, nastiness is the constant quality on which producers depend to put across mediocre songs and otherwise pointless plays. Nastiness is the condiment that goes with cheapness in songs and movies. Sex is a sort of filler to allow them to churn out more product. Plagiarism is the result of mediocre artists being spurred on by non-artistic promoters to produce something that can be dressed up with sufficient attractiveness to draw the public's money. So you got to go to the lowest common denominator, which is sex, violence. But even plagiarism requires a little brains mixed with it, and when the rush of demand overwhelms the available brains, the lack is covered up by an elaborate covering of sensualism. Men who were on the inside of the popular song business and certain court records all testify to the exact truth of these statements. But how did the Jews do it, is a question often asked. The answer is not public demand, nor artistic merit, nor musical ingenuity, nor poetic worth. No, the answer is simple salesmanship. The public doesn't choose. The public simply takes what is persistently thrust upon it. It is a system impossible to any other race but the Jews, for there is no other race that centers its whole interest on the sale. There is no other race that makes so startling a choice in favor of, quote, getting, unquote, money to the exclusion of, quote, making, unquote, money. Who for a moment would think seriously of using the terms production and service with reference to popular songs or motion pictures? Motion pictures in their higher reaches might have some claim to those terms. Not the typical Jewish pictures, however, but the modern crop of popular songs, never. The terms production and service do not belong in the popular song industry at all, but the term salesmanship does, as the reader will presently see. It is well to remember that where there is only salesmanship, without the other two qualities, the public is always the sufferer. Quote, popularity, when interpreted by the Jews who manufactured jazz for the United States, means familiarity. That's all. The theory is that a song need not possess merit as regards words or music to be successful. Italics, it can be popularized artificially by constant repetition until it becomes familiarized to the public ear, and thus familiarized, it becomes, quote-unquote, successful. The principle is expressed in the words of the song, Everybody's Doing It. You go to the theater and hear a song. Next day at a lunch at a cafe, a singer is singing the exact same song. Blaring phonographs used for advertising purposes blat out the same song as you pass on the street. You walk past an afternoon band concert in the park. The band is playing the same song. If you're a normal person, you have a feeling that perhaps something has been going on in the world while you were engaged with your own affairs. The song, you say to yourself, frankly, is silly, and the music trivial. But you keep your opinion a secret because, after all, everybody's singing it. Not long after, you find yourself humming it. You go home and your daughter is practicing up on the piece. It yells its way through your home and through your neighborhood and through your city and through your state till in sheer disgust and in one day the people pitch it bodily out of doors. But behold, another song is waiting to take its place, a song fresh from Yiddish Tin Pan Alley. And the agony is repeated. This occurs from 30 to 50 times a year. That is the principle. Repeat it until it becomes familiar. That gives it the veneer of popularity. Now, there is a method by which all this is done. Nothing happens, in quotes. It is like the mob risings which have been practiced in some of our cities. There is always a well-organized center that knows the technology of riot and knows exactly what it is doing. There is a way of making revolution as common and familiar a thought as the movies and popular songs have made vamps and harems and hooch and hula hula. The principle is the same. Constant repetition for the purpose of familiarization. What could we apply that today in 2015? White privilege. Whites so fragile. Whites are responsible. Whites are pedophiles. Whites are serial killers. Whites are guilty disproportionately of mass shootings is the most recent one. You see? More than one tune has been deliberately rejected by the public, has not been liked, but the song tinkerers did not allow that little fact to intimidate them. They simply hammered it into the ear and memories of the public, knowing that familiarization was obtainable sometime. If we keep repeating it long enough, they'll fall for it. They'll like it, or at least they'll accept it and buy it. Whispering, for example, did not catch on for a long time. Long ago, it used to be known as Johnny's Melody because John Schoenberger wrote it. But finally, it was driven home to its present popularity. There is this to say about it. It is far more deserving of its popularity than is 98% of the so-called popular music. Having a principle, then, that any song can be popularized by constant repetition, the Yiddish music purveyors go about their business very systematically. Again, very similar to what Orwell would write in his book about the system churning out some silly, stupid song mechanically by rote or by computer, and he has the proles singing that as they go about their business. Forget, that's probably in 1984. The song is procured by what means it is not always possible to say. Perhaps one of the staff originates a catchy tune, or a girl who plays the church organ in a distant village sends in a pretty little melody. The girl's melody is, of course, sent back as unsuitable, but if it really had a heart of melody in it, a copy is kept and adapted. In such ways are ideas procured. Then there are plenty of Jewish musical comedies and vaudeville teams. A study of the vaudeville and musical comedy business will show it to be as distinctively Yiddish as are the movies and the popular song industry. So the Jewish song publisher makes an arrangement with the Jewish manager of the musical comedy show. This arrangement provides that one or more of the song's publisher's songs should be sung several times at every performance in response to the applause and encores of a professional song booster's claque, which is always on hand for such purposes. The claque is paid for, just as any other service might be paid for. The night comes, the song is sung, persistent applause, sung again, more applause, apparently the song is a hit. As the audience files out, the lobby is echoing with the cries of Yiddish song vendors proclaiming the song of the evening to be the big hit of the season. Hundreds of copies being sold in the meanwhile. That is the usual Broadway introduction. The next step is to capture the provinces. The musical comedies and vaudeville acts playing within 100 miles of the metropolitan centers. Actors called song pluggers, quote-unquote, are engaged. The arrangement with them, the song pluggers, is that they will sing a particular song exclusively, give no other song a chance. The public pays to hear the actor sing, the manager pays to have him sing, the song publisher pays him to sing a certain song. From theater to theater, from company to company, from artist to artist, the publisher's agents wend their way, making what terms they can to single artists, vaudeville teams, or comedy companies for boosting a new song by giving it a prominent place in the program. There are also the stag entertainers, those young men who go about to parties of one kind or another, offering amusement to the guests. This is a class of entertainers known only to the rich, but numerous enough. For instance, when the Prince of Wales toured America, he was accompanied by a young man nicknamed Rosie, of whose racial origin there need be no doubt. Rosie played the piano and, by songs and antics, beguiled the tedium of the royal journey. Well, young men of Rosie's sort are quite useful in advertising to select circles, the latest product of the Yiddish song factories, and they are, of course, regularly utilized for that purpose. Orchestras, especially those of restaurants and dance halls, are worked in the same way. Get as many people singing and playing introductory renditions as you can. That is the method of gaining an artificial popularity by constant repetition. The chances are that the song you are humming today is being hummed by you simply because you have perforce heard it so often that it beats unconsciously within your brain. These methods are subject to variation, of course. There was a great deal of cutting, quote-unquote, until the right Hebrew group survived, and then there was a great deal of, quote, trust, unquote, method adopted. The Music Publishers Association was organized by Syme Silberman and Morris Goodman, and now all the Jew song manufacturers are included in it. The organization has not changed any of the methods before used, but has curtailed the expense, formed a cartel, that is. Moreover, it has served to relieve the public to this extent that instead of clinging to the one song paid for until the public positively gags on it, the vaudeville or movie performers now sing impartially the various songs of the various publishers forming the trust. More variety has been introduced, that is all. The same old commercialization continues. As readers of the studies of Jewish theatrical control, which appeared in this paper and was talked about in an earlier chapter, will readily understand, The Jewish control of the popular song field means that all non-Jews are barred out. It would be next to impossible for the song of a non-Jew, however meritorious, to reach the public by the usual channels. The musical magazines, again, Jews always set up a filter between them and you so that whether it's a song or whether it's a political idea, or no matter what it is, it has to go through a Jewish filter. That's what's so unique about the internet, is it allows peer-to-peer communication between non-Jews. So I can speak directly to you without any Jew getting in between. The internet is thus an inherently pro-white anti-Semitic medium, or anti-Jewish medium. It would be next to impossible for the song of a non-Jew, no matter how meritorious, to reach the public by the usual channels. He would have to go outside the system, which back then there wasn't the technology. The musical magazines, the musical critics, the musical managers, the musical publishers, the music hall owners, the majority of the performers are not only all Jews, but are Jews consciously banded together to keep out all others. The dishonest methods practiced by the Yiddish controllers of this field have been such as to move the Billboard, the leading vaudeville publication, to refuse to print advertisements calling for song poems. Perhaps the reader has seen such advertisements suggesting that someone has a tune or a song poem that will probably make a fortune if only sent on to an address on Broadway or in the region of Tin Pan Alley. The Billboard says, "No more song poem ads accepted." Block quote. This is a quote from it. After investigating the business methods practiced by some song poem advertisers, the Billboard believes it to be the best interest of its readers to eliminate the heading Music and Words under which song poem advertisements appeared, and hereafter, or until existing conditions are changed, the Billboard will not accept any more song poem advertising from any concern or person. That's the end of the direct quote right there. Everywhere the popular song has been attacked by keen observers of social tendencies, but the attack has not been made intelligently. No public menace like this can be abolished without showing the public the source of it. Newspapers are now beginning to attack jazz, the vicious movies, the disgraceful dance. Others attack the young folks who sing jazz, the people who patronize the objectionable movies, the throngs who indulge in indecent dancing. But all the time, a small group of men are deliberately and systematically, again, notice the words that he used. One of the main values of us reading this is to teach you how to talk against the Jews and explain what they're doing. And when specific terms are useful, he says, deliberately and systematically. The point is to point out to people that this is all organized from the top down. And it's not just, yeah, we're talking about public songs. That's just one manifestation of this control. Everywhere you look, it's deliberate and organized, but the goyim, like the stupid cattle the Jews consider us to be, always go after this specific manifestation rather than the source and the cause of it. If you wipe out the cause, if you turn the tap off, you don't get any more water droplets on the floor, right? You would think that would be self-evident, but it's not at all, particularly to Christian conservatives. It really is. It's a version of that great minds talk about ideas, average minds talk about people, and small minds or gossip. You know, I got it a little wrong, but you get the basic idea, and that's how it is. The average mind cannot see anything deeper than the babbling interplay of personalities, so he can't stick to any principles. And that same level, when he's trying to understand something, all he can... He gets fixated on someone like Barack Obama and cannot see the actual ideas trust, as it were, that's operating and producing Obama and Hillary Clinton and the rest. So that it doesn't matter if Obama is the guy in office or not, someone else is going to be pushing the same policies. They can't relate to anything other than what they see right in front of their face, because they really aren't any more than animals. They're saying exactly the same things that a cow would say if a cow could talk. Now, but all the time, a small group of men are deliberately and systematically forcing jazz and movies and dances upon the country, spending hundreds of thousands in the effort and reaping millions in profits. If these men were non-Jews, a multitude of fingers would be pointed toward them in identification and denunciation. Because these men are Jews, they are allowed to go free. You will stop these abuses when you point out the Jewish group behind them. People sometimes say, well, if you went after any other nationality, you could find just as much fault as with the Jews. Is there any other nationality on which you can fasten the responsibility for vile movies? Is there any other on which you can fasten the responsibility for the illicit liquor traffic? Has any other nationality control of the theater? In the beginning, the action against the Popular Song Trust, could the United States find anyone to indict besides Jewish song publishers? And could the U.S. government lay less than 80% of song control to one New York group alone? If these things were not strictly Jewish in their origin, method, and purpose, how could such statements be made? Jews say, clean up among the Gentiles first, and then turn attention to us. Will the Jews charge Gentile control of movies, popular songs, horse racing, baseball gambling, theaters, the illicit liquor traffic? Will the Jews charge Gentile predominance in any line recognized by moralists today as dangerously menacing the public welfare? You're saying, are Jews denying? Are they really claiming that Gentiles control all those things when anyone looking at it can see that they're clearly controlled by Jews? The question is too big to be explained by prejudice. The facts are too challenging to be thrust aside as universal. It is a Jewish question made such by a series of Jewish facts. The facts say it's Jews dominate all these businesses, and these businesses influence the public, and the influence is profoundly, systematically, and deliberately negative. Jews are a social menace. Whites cannot allow them to live among whites without courting and eventually realizing the destruction not only of their culture, but the genocide of their kind. See, that's what we know because we're not in Ford's time. We're 100 years later, and that's where it all culminates. Not just the destruction of your society, your morals, and then your society, but the actual physical disappearance of your kind. That's what Tin Pan Alley is singing about. Not content with hedging life about on every side, from the gold that is used in business to the grain that is used in bread, Jewish influence enters your parlor and determines what you shall sing at your piano or hear upon your music reproducing machine. If you could put a tag marked Jewish on every part of your life that is Jew-controlled, you would be astonished at the showing. This was written 100 goddamn years ago. It is to laugh, and it is to cry, and it is to get angry about. And that final article appeared on the 13th of August, 1921. So these two that we just did today were both from August of 1921 about Jewish domination of the popular song and the music industry. I've been Alex Linder, and everything that we record is part of our Learning College and the Unabridged, the International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem by Henry Ford, can be found at vnnforum.com. So thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.